It was Minneapolis, early to mid-1970s. There was almost no original music locally, and nowhere for the earliest rock bands to perform it in town.
There weren't too many bands that were all that interesting.
The kind of the hits of that time were Foreigner and REO Speedwagon and that kind of stuff. So it got really pretty schmaltzy and corny.
It was a four-set-a-night cover band scene.
Kind of every band kind of had a similar sound in town.
What we were going to see and what we were hearing on the radio were inspirational to the Commandos because we didn't like a lot of it.
You know, I'm a teenager. I wanted to rock.
Change was in the air, and a few bands dared to be different.
This is Rock and Roll Radio. Come on, let's rock and roll with
the Suburbs.
Hey! Hey! I feel good. Kurt Olmsted, better known as Curtis A.
So if I play you the right, I could change your mind.
The Suicide Commandos. The Flame and Nose, NNB, Fingerprints, and more. Minneapolis bands such as these were inspired by bands in other parts of the US and Britain they found out about via radio, rock magazines, and concerts.
Like MC5,
the loud English rock, like The Who, loudness, slam bang, attractive to young men.
So excited to meet somebody that was as crazy as I was about Bowie.
72, you know, Bowie had come to the United States for his first tour in Ziggy Stardust show, which was absolutely mind-bending and life-changing.
To me, Bowie was kind of the seed. He really had an underground cachet of coolness.
Still don't know what I was waiting for.
Johnny Rotten, with his hair all hacked off, and Sid Vicious with chains. I mean, that was really badass. The Stooges in New York, you'd hear Television, Talking Heads, and Ramones, of course.
Kevin Cole, currently a KEXP Seattle, Washington program director and DJ, was an early Minneapolis rock music fan during this era and was inspired by the new scene. He would go on to become a renowned Minneapolis DJ for nearly two decades.
I went and did an internship at WGTB in Washington, D.C. in like 76. It was a complete epiphany in terms of programming freeform radio and also what was going on musically at that time. So the Sex Pistols record was coming out. Yeah, the Eno records. And that really opened my mind to new music, or that there was something going on in music that I had been craving. That captured the essence of the 60s music that when I was really young, even though I didn't know how to describe what I was enjoying and liking, I felt was missing in music. When I heard the Ramones, I purged my record collection.
One pivotal performance was the New York Dolls performing the Minnesota State Fair, 1974.
Personality crisis. One.
Suicide Commandos' Chris Osgood and Dave All remember.
A lot of people have come to think that that was sort of the beginning of a new chapter being written as the Dolls coming to town, and people like us thinking about the possibilities. I was determined to get backstage after their set and talk with them, which I did, and got all of their autographs on my white jean jacket. The thing that most impressed me about the Dolls was, number one, how hilarious they were, and number two, what poor players they were. That wasn't the point. Mm-hmm. So for me, a light bulb went off, and I went, hey, wait a minute. Maybe the message is more important than the medium, which was not the lesson that you got in blues training, was that you had to have chops. But for that kind of rock and roll, forget it. All you had to have was charisma.
During ninth grade, future Suicide Commandos Chris Osgood and Dave All saw one of their earliest influences at a Steve Miller Band concert.
And the opening band was a band from England called the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. And they just rocked our world. They rocked my world. They were so funny. It was revelatory. I'd never had so much fun at a rock show or realized that music could be that clever. Something that the Commandos were pretty good at was reacting to what was going on around us and either making fun of it or joining in, but just being tuned in to what was happening and not locked into, we're going to play these 15 songs in this set. You know, we were always goofing around, and Dave and I had played together since ninth grade, so we knew, had an idea of the sense of humor of the other person and what might or might not happen. So by the time the Commandos came around, Dave and I had both played hundreds of shows.
Chris Osgood recalls the existing Minneapolis music scene before they were inspired by the New York Dolls and other irreverent rockers.
The scene before the Longhorn for me was the West Bank, the Triangle and the Caboose and the Flame down on Nicollet. I would go down to the Triangle Bar and see Roy Alstead play and go sneak in, by the way, and sneak into the Flame Bar to see Willie and the Bees play.
Kurt Olmsted, later known as Curtis A., was paving the way for the Minneapolis music scene as early as 1974, when his 60s band Wire reformed as Thumbs Up and were performing at Minneapolis bar The CC Tap, now known as The CC Club.
Playing on the ground, having lots of fun till the sun goes down. People got to know, miles and miles around, got to hear the secret of their rock and roll sound. Everybody stop, playing on the ground.
We all went away for a year and came back and rejoined as Thumbs Up, and then we came to town and began a year-long residence at the CC Tap, and that's where New Wave started. As far as I'm concerned, New Wave started across the street at the Or Folk, because all these record clerks worked there, Peter Jesperson and Andy Schwartz. Peter Jesperson said that he walked across the street and heard us doing I Want to Meet You by the Crying Shames.
Or Folk Jokopus Record Store was located on 25th and Lindale, across the street from the CC Tap. Peter Jesperson, an Or Folk manager at the time, walked across the street to the CC Tap to get sandwiches for the rest of the Or Folk staff. He had an epiphany when he suddenly heard Thumbs Up.
I heard music playing, and I looked in the back, and there was a band on stage. And I was like, oh, I didn't know they had live bands here. The band was playing a song called Tell Her No by the Zombies, which was a favorite of mine. And I was like, oh, that's cool. What a great choice of covers song. And they went into another one by a group from Chicago called the Crying Shames, a song called I Want to Meet You. And it was really a favorite of mine, and not as common, perhaps, as the Zombies song was. And I thought, well, wow, this is kind of obscure, and what another great choice of covers. And I was really impressed with the group. And as it turned out, this group was Thumbs Up, and the lead singer was Kurt Olmsted, and the lead guitar player was Bob Dunlap, and who later, of course, was nicknamed Slim and joined the Replacements for the latter half of their career. But the light bulb went off for me, and I thought, hey, there's some great music being made here in Minneapolis. And we began to follow Thumbs Up all over town. Wherever they played, a bunch of us that worked at the record store, or people that hung around the record store, became a little bit of a fan club posse sort of thing for them, and followed them around. One of the guys actually hauled a reel-to-reel tape recorder around to record Thumbs Up. We just liked them so much, we wanted to capture some of those performances.
What you
So that was really where the interest in the Minneapolis scene began, was with Thumbs Up, and particularly Kurt Olmsted, I think one of the great singers in the history of Minneapolis rock.
A few pivotal Minneapolis bands were inspired by Thumbs Up as well. Curtis A. remembers seeing them.
Prodigy, Future, Flamin' and the Commandos were too young to get in, but I think some of them snuck in sometimes. I know for sure they did.
Suicide Commando Steve Almas recalls meeting fellow Suicide Commandos around the time of watching Thumbs Up.
Right when I started meeting those guys, Kurt still had the band Thumbs Up, and they were still playing in the CC, and they were fantastic. You know, they were doing like all 60s music, and they could sing and play just great.
I want to tell you how I feel today.
Bob Dunlap, later nicknamed Slim, reflects on what made Kurt Olmsted special to play with.
Most band leaders would teach you the way they wanted it, and the way they wanted it is the way it had to be, or they would get discouraged with your efforts. And it was fun to play with Kurt because he would always be in kind of state of adapting things to the band, and he didn't have to do it the same way every time because he didn't do it the same way every time. So it kind of fostered a feeling of there's no one way to do this song. And I admire that. To dare to change something in front of a live audience. The bands that kind of came along that formed the original music scene all kind of started deviating from the norm, and that kind of appealed to me because I wasn't interested in being in a jam band. Still am not.
The Suicide Commandos met while they were still in high school. Almost went to Hopkins. Osgood and all went to Minnetonka. Osgood and all held farmhouse parties near where they lived, and they jammed together with Almas. A year later, they invited Almas to form a band, and they became the Suicide Commandos.
When I graduated from high school, I went off to the University of Minnesota for a year, and I remember once getting a call from those guys about starting a band where we had to all dress up like insects or something, and that wasn't the most exciting idea I'd ever heard. And the next year, Chris and Dave invited me over to their house and said, you know, we want to have a three-piece band, and we wanted to keep it three-piece so we can make the most money. And and I thought, both Chris and Dave were guys, you know, they weren't really like anybody I'd ever met. And I guess maybe even just being a couple years older, but they certainly seemed worldly to me.
Three cool cats. I sit on the corner in a beat-up car, splitting up a little candy bar, talking about how sharp they are.
Randy Levy and Sue McLean of Shone Productions in Minneapolis became the Suicide Commandos' booking agents after a nearly disastrous audition. Osgood and all remember.
See, but that guy said to us after our set, I wouldn't touch you with a 10-foot pole. And he walked out, and the Marsh guy walked out, and Sue stuck around, and she goes, well, yeah, I'll start booking you right away.
We became Sue's prom band, playing high school proms. And
charged between $200 and $500 to go out and play a show, and it was my job to pitch those, about five or six bands. But I would always say, and then there's this last band, the Suicide Commandos, that you can get for $150, and they'll come out and play your high school, and they'll be great. Kids love them. And kids did love us, but principals hated us.
Hey, Dave, what are you doing this weekend?
1, 2, 3, 4.
First band at practice, take a Mando jacket. Feel like got a job to do, haven't gone to see a dude. Give him mama, let him shoot. Give him time to bear a boot. I'm wrong, get in there.
The Suicide Commandos began performing and touring in 1975. They began playing the Blitz Bar in downtown Minneapolis in fall of 75 and Pryor Place in Pryor Lake during the winter of 76. Also, they performed twice with the Ramones at Kelly's Pub in the summer of 77.
We started working our way up to, you know, bigger venues, bigger gigs. We played a lot at Kaufman, and by that time, we had some notoriety, so Sue and Randy Levy were letting us open for shows, you know, when people were coming to town. So by that time, we were getting to be the opening band at the State Theater, for example. And that's when things really started to ramp up for us, because that was Cheap Trick and Patti Smith and
Iggy
at the State. That was very fun. We played with the Ramones over there in 77. Did the Blitz Bar up until about December, and then I remember us playing at Prior Place all through the winter and into the summer, and we graduated from the little lounge to the big lounge. Consequently, got bigger audiences and more angry audiences. That's where people first hung around to beat us up after shows, was down there at Prior Place.
We just didn't understand.
No.
Bands who wanted to play original music were initially playing covers at the Blitz Bar in downtown Minneapolis. The Blitz Bar was an early part of the Minneapolis scene building prior to Jay's Longhorn hosting these bands performing their original music. The Suicide Commandos' Osgood, All, and Almas reflect on early days at the Blitz Bar.
We managed to get a job in downtown Minneapolis at a place called the Blitz Bar, and once we started playing at the Blitz Bar, we met Curtis A., who had the band Thumbs Up then, and we met Robert Wilkinson, who had the band Prodigy then, and we made friends with these guys. Something to remember about the whole punk scene, it was very, very small.
It was very much a slow build for the Commandos, but we played at a place called the Blitz Bar, which was right downtown, in the basement, below a strip club on 5th Street.
Across the street from what would become the Longhorn, but that was a jazz club. The Blitz Bar was lit by black lights, and anybody that had soda or tonic in their drink glowed. Each time we played, there'd be more and more glowing drinks on the... We couldn't see the people, but I could see the glowing drinks on the tables by the disembodied floating drinks, mysteriously gliding in the semi-darkness.
Looks like you had to ask yourself.
And there were bullet holes in the, you know, somebody had died sitting on the toilet, shot when they were there. So yeah, we would go across the street to the Longhorn, where they had nice bathrooms. The guy that hired us there and would go around to the registers was murdered himself. And that was the end of our gigs at the Blitz.
The earliest bands were based on friendships. Chen Poling, upon his return from California, wanted to join the Suicide Commandos. Instead, Chris Osgood connected him with friends, and they became the Suburbs.
I never had seen them or heard them play, but I knew they were doing, I just knew his sensibility, and I knew kind of channeling the Ramones and all that kind of stuff, and I loved that. So I came back to Minneapolis and told Chris, I said, here's some songs I want to do, I've been writing lately, and they were songs that ended up on that little red record, the Suburbs' first EP, songs like Stereo and Go and My Phone and all that kind of real short little punky tunes. He said, oh, you know, would be great for you to meet would be Bruce Allen and Michael Halliday. They're really on the same direction. And I think you really get along with them. And I was a pal with Beege since I was 13, 14 years old. So when we were teenagers, we were kind of in the same scene and hung out. And I'd brought Beej kind of into the fold too. We were old friends. I started breaking away a little bit, really was into jazz, and I still am with my group, the New Standards. We kind of explore a little bit with jazz. But so Beej and I came back and hooked up with Bruce, and our first record came out in 1977.
It was by like 77, the Suburbs played with us on New Year's, I think right when they were starting, because half of them were Chris and Dave's friends and the other half were my friends. You know, then they just took off and it all just kind of snowballed. And it was a very intense couple of years there, the, 77, 78, 79 years at the Longhorn.
Steve Almas was friends with the Suburbs' Bruce Allen since first grade. They had a junior high school band together and later lived together downtown, where Bruce Allen worked as a commercial artist. Almas was also friends with Suburbs' bass player Michael Halliday since ninth grade.
Bruce Allen, the lead guitar player, he and I went to first grade together. He was really like my oldest friend. These were my friends, and Beej and Chan were Minnetonka guys that knew Chris and Dave. I think it was Bruce and Mike that knew Hugo. It was just directly from us knowing these guys that they all got together.
The New Musical Express, better known as The Enemy, was a rock music magazine from England comparable to Spin. The Enemy was testing the American market, and in 1972, Peter Jesperson began delivering The Enemy to Minneapolis record stores such as Electric Fetus and North Country, which became Orfolk Jokopus. Jesperson became friends with Orfolk record store owner Vern Sandham and was hired there less than a year later. Orfolk Jokopus was renowned for carrying numerous imports and getting them in store first. DJ Kevin Cole, an early Minneapolis music fan, talks about the role of Orfolk Jokopus in music fans' lives.
Hand in hand with the Longhorn at that time, Orfolk Jokopus was the place you'd go in the daytime versus the Longhorn at night. It was really interesting. It took a lot of work to be a music fan at that time. Basically, I mean, there was no internet. Orfolk Jokopus was the internet, basically. I mean, that's where you had to go. And I'd go on the day they'd get new releases or imports, and you'd buy NME, New Music Express, you'd buy the Melody Maker, you'd buy the New York Rocker. The three sort of publications would help inform you as to what was going on, you know, what was going on in New York, what was going on in London. And you had to build relationships with the people who worked at those record stores and hang out and listen, and what are they going to put on next? Orfolk was, for me, that portal. It was the internet of 1977, 78, 79.
Various musicians remember, such as Richard Champ of NMB, who also worked at Orfolk Jokopus.
In large part, the people who gravitated to that scene were clustered around the bands that eventually took the stage at a place like the Longhorn. Many of us were really from the ashes, if you will, of glam rock, the world at Orfolk Jokopus. You know, when I look back, I try to find milestones. One of my favorites is the day I met Peter Jesperson. There was that record store scene that was colliding with and kind of welcoming and joining with the very few bands that were actually playing sort of original music at the time.
Guitarist Slim Dunlap talks about Orfolk manager Jesperson's role as a tastemaker in Minneapolis. Jesperson would go on to co-found Twin Tone record label.
And Peter has always been just kind of a real key figure in the local scene as to helping songwriters kind of find their style just by showing interest in it and kind of showing disinterest in their lesser songs. Just, and if Peter was interested in it, then you kind of knew that people would be interested in it.
Suicide Commando Steve Almus also recalls Jesperson and Orfolk fellow staff member Andy Schwartz.
Peter Jesperson I went to junior high and high school with, too, although he was two grades ahead of me. He was the kid in high school. He was the kid with the longest hair in school. But he was always, you know, into something interesting even then. And then when we came downtown and started playing and everything, you know, we met up again, of course, because he was working and managing in that store. He and I spent a lot of time listening to music, for sure. And Andy Schwartz, who ended up later being manager of Beat Rodeo and the editor of the New York Rocker, he was working there. He was living in Minneapolis then. He was another one that really helped the Commandos a lot.
The Suburbs Gem pulling reflex on hanging out at Orfolk.
But so Orfolk was where we'd go to hang out, and Peter Jesperson worked there. It was kind of our little clubhouse, so we'd go there and get all the new records from New York and Europe and stuff. But Orfolk really was the kind of nurturing punk rock new wave center, definitely. We'd go to Orfolk and just hang out there for just hours. For some reason, this is a weird little arcane knowledge, back then everybody in the in our little underground rock scene was big fans of All My Children, the soap opera. So we get together and talk about All My Children. Isn't that weird? And since we worked at night, you know, we'd get up, we'd wake up and watch that soap opera. That was our start of our day.
Almost became intrigued with New York City and CBGBs via photos and tapes he saw while living in a house with Robert Wilkinson of the Flaming O's.
I'm looking at this and just going, this seems like, you know, the greatest thing I've ever seen.
Osgood made a phone call.
He just called up CBGBs and asked if we could play there, and they couldn't believe that, you know, a band from Minnesota would want to come all the way out there. But in June of 1976, we played at CBGBs.
The Suicide Commandos playing CBGBs in New York made a huge impact on the Minneapolis music scene.
Yeah, we had a meeting at Andy Schwartz's house, and we didn't have a place to play. It was before the Longhorn, and Andy felt really strongly that we needed to make a scene. That's what begat that very concert with us and Riff Raff and Prodigy. Is there was, you know, the real rock and roll scene, but there was no club to support it. And then, as if by magic, Jay's Longhorn opened up. We had been playing out in New York, and we came back to town, remember? And there was this new club called Jay's Longhorn, and Kurt was playing down there, and, you know, immediately we all flocked down to support each other, which is really what CBGB's was. It's a place where musicians went to support each other, and then it sort of caught on. You know, when we would be down playing at CBGB's, the first people to see us play were the other bands. People started going to the Longhorn. It was this new kind of music, the blues, you know, Charlie and Lamont Cranston and all that. That was still raging on just fine. You know, Willie and the Bees and that scene closer to the university area, that all continued on. But suddenly there was this other thing, and that was downtown. And sort of the nexus of that was 26th and Lindale, because people would go to Orfolk to see what was going on. That was sort of the headquarters of the hip. And then the club started to open, and people got to know each other, and that really there was a scene. The future ain't tomorrow. Now the changes have begun. We got to get a handle on some complicated fun.
To hear more, listen to part two of Minneapolis Music Scene, 1975 to 1980. I'm Sin Collins for KFAI.
Funding for Miniculture on KFAI comes from listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Foundation.